Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I'm lucky to have as my guest Martin Amis, whose novel, Yellow Dog, was published by Miramax Books. Now, as I started reading this book, I had recently stopped smoking. So I read it with the forced attentiveness of someone trying not to smoke and keep his eyes on the page. And so a rather obsessional reading occurred in a novel that seemed to me to be obsessionally constructed, in fact. So I was finding myself following these characters up all kinds of false paths through false vicinities. A character in the first pages is going to Hollywood, but it turns out to be the name of a bar in the East End. He's going to be going to hospital. He's been accused eventually of having grassed on Joseph Andrews, who for me is a hero of a Henry Fielding novel. And so throughout, I was reading like a lunatic, like a reader of a middle Nabokov English novel, novel in English rather, not English novel, tracking down what I thought were constantly coups, and enjoying this book because it seemed the most giddy and maddened of the novels thus constructed by you. Is that the case? To what extent am I correct, and to what extent am I merely an addled non-smoker?
Well, I sympathize with your giving up smoking. It's what I'm attempting to do at the moment.
Oh, good luck.
there is no hotter hell, I think, than trying to kick the habit. But I did feel that this was a more antic novel than perhaps I've ever written. Playful, but giddy, as you say. I was well into it when September the 11th happened, and had to put it aside for a couple of weeks after that event, because the voice coming out of my study seemed like a squeak. A mouse squeak. But then when I resumed it, I thought, it's too early yet to take on September the 11th as these things have to, as Norman Mailer said, they have to sink into your subconscious before you can write fiction about them. But I did think this will be, by definition, a post-September the 11th novel. Let's have a sort of patina that refers to that, but also let's reaffirm that it's to be a comic novel, because of all the things that were attacked on that day, for instance, civilization, also humor. It was a massively unsmiling event. And it seemed more urgent than ever to reassert the force of humor. And also with the feeling that given the current culture and ideology in the West, that humor is actually doomed. You can almost imagine a committee settling down and unsmilingly dedicating itself to the abolition of humor.
The king in this novel, Henry IX, has a scandal manager whose name, thanks to an acronym of his initials, is Bugger, and his servant Love is named, in fact, Love, and leads to sentences like "Bring me another cocktail, Love." So it seems as if naming in itself causes these people to seem to be swearing or to be proffering endearments, and the book seems to be about the ways in which language keeps throwing us jokes that we can't make or take back.
Yeah, well, people accuse me of assigning joke names, and I would you know, a joke name in my view is something like Montezuma or, you know, Oedipus Mass. Or my names are all real names. They're names that exist in telephone books. But the way they're juxtaposed feels very important to me. I mean, if you're going to have a main character in a novel, you're going to use that name maybe 300 times in the book. And I think it ought to bring some weight with it. They shouldn't be called Tom Metcalf, you know. That shouldn't have a dead name. Should have a name. Everyone should have a name that's doing a bit of work.
In Yellow Dog, by my guest Martin Amis, the subject seems to be the kind of trapeze work that can be done with reputation, or even that a husband, in this case, Zan Mio, he has really resolved to lead a blameless life with a second wife, and is doing so. Although she's nervous, he's nervous, the ex-wife is fostering nervousness, and a whole set of events are going to cause his past to emerge, are going to take over his brain chemistry so that he doesn't have access to the man who made the resolve to be a better man.
Well, he's you know, as the novel opens, before he gets hit on the head and has a head injury that changes his personality, he's you know, almost too right on, really. He's a good modern person, you know, who accepts the contemporary package. And once he's hit on the head, ancient male drives push out all these rather too carefully fostered, almost to the point of illusion, these views that are part of the Western package. And he becomes a pig, or a caveman, all over again.
And as we read, we're going to move from group to group whose connections can't quite be ascertained on a first reading, and one group who come out of nowhere on an airplane bearing a coffin in the hold. A lot is happening in this book that is darker, in fact, than it seems, because so much elusive suggestiveness is causing the book to stay suspended. In this kind of book, right, the reader has to file keywords, in a sense, what Kenneth Burke used to call a word index. He described reading Ulysses as virtually turning the mind into an index of recurring words, waiting for the next shoe to drop. And so for me, it became an interesting comedy, because someone who has had a head injury and can't recall very much, can't say, in fact, that he does recall crucial things that will be central to the book, because he doesn't want people to know that he's, in fact, not amnestic. This whole book becomes, to me, a kind of board game about what anger and forgiveness, forgetfulness, political correctness do to the raging organism of someone trying merely to respond to life as it occurs.
Yes, it's not, well, the amnesia is there as a sort of plot device, but as Elmore Leonard said, if you have a plot that's based on amnesia, you don't have a plot. you don't have a plot. So I wanted to, the blow to the head is also very, very remotely September the 11th kind of event that puts the main character into a state of shock and a sort of reeling state. And I did want to sort of turn the world upside down, and the criminal, Joseph Andrews, who sort of dominates the second half of the novel, gives us a version of an inverted world where values are turned absolutely on their head. You'll notice the pub he used to go to in the West End is the world upside down, a place that actually exists. And I think, you know, that what I couldn't yet do in this novel because of the sort of time restriction, but I felt very much the presence of an inverted moral system out there in the world, which we now see getting more and more magical realist in its demands and methods. You know, Al-Qaeda, not Al-Qaeda, but Al-Qaedaism, that is now, you know, seems to be spreading like a virus into a kind of cult of carnage, without any realistic political aims at all. So it was inverted moral worlds was what I wanted to investigate. And even the hack journalist Clint Smoker, who works for the unbelievably vulgar tabloid The Morning Lark, occupies a kind of inverted world where good is bad and bad is good.
I'm speaking to Martin Amis about his newest novel, Yellow Dog. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm. For me, the pleasure, and it was constant, was of stumbling through thickets of carefully disorienting prose. The primary example being that this king has an affair with a Chinese woman whose name is He, and we're up to reading sentences which begin, "He touched him," and
he touched He.
He yes. touched He, and there's to my mind the sense that this world has lost its bearings because you can't look at it. By this world, I mean both the world in the book and the world outside the book, that you can no longer look at its language and say what it is, that people are speaking nowadays with such odd decorums, and there are so many more universal social mores to be breached that people are becoming improbably polite. And the book is a recording device, a black box in one of its parts, for events that you can't quite replay or parse afterwards.
Yeah. Each group of characters, this is one of those novels where you introduce to four situations in the early pages, and the convention is how are these going to be brought together? And they are sort of in the plot, but each has a kind of a language. The tabloid journalist, the king, Zanmir, and for instance, Clint Smoker's girlfriend, with whom he communicates by email, creates this sort of disgusting language of acute abbreviations and futile bits of ingenuity on the keyboard, and she is using this language for the discourse of flirtation and even deep feeling.
One of my favorite moments in the book is he's rather nervous. In fact, while he's working for this pornographic tabloid, he's rather sexually nervous and looks for a woman who is going to overlook or even not find inadequate his inadequacies. This woman says to him in her emails that she doesn't think, in fact, that size matters. And she has a numerical computer ease so that A with a circle stands for at, and she spells natural, N, A with circle, etc. So she says she hopes that he is like other men. Does he have 21? He recoils thinking, 21? But she's been writing 2 and the 1 is an L.
Yeah.
Does he have a tool at all?
Yeah.
And he is part of this crazy code that then the reader has to go back. And I say it's a model for the book, that every couple of pages, the book is playing a game that the reader can't at first recognize until it's contextualized. And it's suggesting that a lot of what's interpreted as permissible morality in the actual world has come about because of a misreading and encoding a set of false names, that the book is a game version, a Parcheesi version, of a world already made into a Parcheesi board and turned crazy by the inversion of rules and mores, that the book is actually not moral or immoral, but a presentation of a world that's become impossible to read morally altogether.
Well, I don't abjure the right to have a moral stance. And, it has to be there implicitly for anything to register, I think. Although, following Nabokov, I try to do it not by, cornally punishing my characters or tritely converting them, but using style as a sort of moral directive. In his criticism, he says, when you've got your gangster in your novel, then the way you punish him is not by having a tiptoeing conspirator come up behind him with a handgun. No, you punish him by watching him pick his nose with an inquisitive pinky and then examining, the contents underneath his nail. You make the wicked ridiculous, and that is comedy's traditional way of punishing. And people fear ridicule as much almost as they fear physical violence, and it is a potent weapon.
Now, both Nabokov and Joyce are people who used note cards in various ways. What I'm trying to suggest here is that while you admire them, your interest is much more improvisatory. You don't strike me as a novelist who is playing a consistent chess game throughout the book. In fact, far from it. That it goes as far as the author's ingenuity will take it. It's meant to address the reader, but it's not meant to be thorough or obsessional in quite that way. You're not the bug collecting type, I think.
No. And it's like, Saul Bellow's novel, The Adventures of Augie March, there are millions of classical references in that, and there is a sort of quest and Ulysses imagery. But it's not systematic. It's something freer than that. And I think, if you have a spectrum with life at one side and other books or literature on the other side, Nabokov and Joyce are well over towards the literature end of this scale, whereas Bellow, although intensely literary, is very much more towards the life. And I feel, that earlier on I might have been the kind of writer that was leaning to the literary, the inward-looking, words, the ludic playing with words and charting the chess game from start to finish, but have felt increasingly that something more fast-flowing, more catch-as-catch-can that kind of energy has to be admitted to.
It's interesting because for me this is your wackiest novel in years. It has more, it's not tethered, but it has more of that kind of, if you can connect nothing with nothing on Mog of Sands, how about this? And the reader is constantly looking for the missing link. I liked it because it didn't have that you are now caught in a literary police state in which your ability to find clues will allow you passage to a new country at the end of the book. Rather, it seemed like the world had become, as I suggested, a board game whose rules were missing, and the reader is being asked to try and play several games at once, never quite sure if he's caught on. I like the feel of a book that moves slightly faster than the reader can catch up. For me, not so much like the Nabokov novel written by Bellow, but like a Queneau novel written by Bellow.
Queneau,
a kind of Oulipo pastime where lots of puns and language games are being played, evaded, picked up again, the feeling being one of off again, on again. that to be human is not to be consistently moral or consistently immoral, that now you play at this game and now that one, and all kinds of people are less than consistent. If an earlier kind of novel was teaching us about the consistency of characters, morally, physically, otherwise, these characters, they're moral one minute, immoral the next, and hypocritical about their morality. And that seems to be the lesson of the Amos morality. Stop pretending the consistency of a chivalric, of a coated sword, can be found anymore. We move from square to square, inventing the rules for ourselves as we go. And so sometimes we may be like angels, but other times we may be mere punsters.
I did want it to be a sort of unholy brew, as well as having sort of a narrative force. I mean, it seems to me that the literary novel is, in fact, its days are perhaps numbered, or it will revert to being what it was when I entered it, which was a minority interest sphere. I mean, look what has already happened to poetry. We are in a post-poetic age. It's not dumbing down so much as numbing down. Life happens too quickly now. History has accelerated to the point where we can't do what the poem wants us to do, which is to slow down and stop the clock. Because of the momentum of modern life. And also perhaps we don't want us to enter that state of introspection which a poem forces on you. When I do read poetry now, because my life has slowed down somewhat, I feel a sort of tingling feeling that revisiting a state that used to be part of my everyday life, where you enter into the poet's introspection, and that somehow includes you, and you enter your own introspection at the same time. But that poetry has vanished. Its constituency is not that the poets aren't there; they're there, and they're as good as they ever were. But the kind of solitude and introspection that poetry demands is being squeezed out of our life. Now, a literary novel will slow the clock down too, and this is sort of resented by the culture, I think. You're reading some piece in The New Yorker about Iraq or Iran, and there's this poem in the middle of the page, and the eye almost sort of, with a mind of its own, rejects this little island of calm and introspection. And on we flow with Iraq and North Korea, etc. So there won't be a place for the clock stopping kind of writing. And I think many writers are responding to this not out of calculation but out of instinct, and also they're part of the modern world too, by injecting more pace into The 600-page rambling, essayistic kind of novel is a harder sell, I'd have thought, in our world than it was a generation ago.
That's interesting, because isn't it? I mean, I think what you're talking about comes up and subsides. That you get an Anthony Burgess writing Tremor of Intent, and then you get Gravity's Rainbow. That the literary novel takes on its pace and its imitations of other forms, and then somehow or other, I think when things become so extreme that people want to retreat into a novel and suddenly, perhaps by mistake, but say, I forgot what could be found there. Mm. I forgot the kind of solace that this irresolvability offers, while that, the irresolvability of the world, is painful and unbearable. So I think it goes back and forth, in fact.
And it returns as an antidote.
As an antidote to really fierce times, which I think we're in. I prefer reading Yellow Dog, as vilified as this novel was by critics who were suggesting that it was demonic. This was the maniacal novel. And yet, for me, it gave me a chance for laughter and, reveling in the true scum of inventiveness which is not characteristic of the external world. Maybe you find scum there and invention, but the double duty job is a writer's, it seems to me.
Yes, indeed. I mean, and here you can examine the questions of, you know, violence and masculinity behind, you know, nice, safe, hard covers. You can confront the, you know, the worst people on earth at a safe distance and use the weapon of humor to sort of cauterize them and isolate them and expel them.
Boy, am I in a contradictory mood today, because, you see, I find the pleasure, I'm a bit, my glasses are very thick. I keep the page close to my face. I find that I'm getting closer to these people when I read than I would dare to do in life, and that the fun and thrill is I let them closer to me, at least ocularly, closer to my mind, than I would let them in a tabloid. I know that other people live differently, but I find that reading this kind of demonic fiction brings me closer to a world rather than further from it. And I understand why people were threatened by this book. They didn't want what they were reading to represent a world that they recognized. It's a scary book, but also scarier because so funny. And because it's pulling the floor out, the rug out from under you. Every couple of pages, every couple of paragraphs, you're being asked to resituate yourself. What? I thought, whose name? Ah? And I think that, too, is putting people on the hot seat, you know? What is it like to not be able to interpret the information that's being directed at you via avalanche?
Yeah. No, it is. It's meant to be a confluence of all sorts of hideous threads in the modern world, and here they all are in one package. But I like Updike's remark. You know, we're talking about repulsive characters, he says that. You know, we like them. What we like is life, he said. So if it's vivid, if it's alive, then we like these characters, you know, no matter how unspeakably they behave.
I've been speaking to Martin Amis, whose most recent novel, Yellow Dog, is from Miramax Books. Thank you, Martin, for joining me.
Thank you very much, Michael.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Ray Guarna. Special production assistance from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword Bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with Book of the Mouse Club time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.